Is that Monique?
Mr. Zadlow, it's nice to see you, sir.
Frank.
Been a while. Monique, you're back with us then?
Yes, I'm here.
Oh, good. Hi. Yeah, that sounds great. Much less feedback. It worked. So, Monique, you're the new kid on the block for this evening. Not that we want to embarrass you at all, but it sure is nice to embarrass people. I don't know if you've ever had the opportunity to do it. how can the Night Sky Sangha entertain you? Or not, feel free to join us vicariously if you'd like.
Maybe she can't hear us.
I don't know if Monique can't hear us or we can't hear her.
Would you mind to repeat, please?
Oh, good. Yeah, there you are. I was I was asking how might the Night Sky Sangha serve you?
Well, I am. You're asking me specifically to me or to everybody?
Well, all the other hobos on the call are, you know, fairly well known to me.
Unstable connection.
I just wanted to give you the opportunity to share something or ask a question if you had one.
Yes. Well, I've been on spiritual quest for a very, very long time, and looking for ways to. I have this need to have question answered, or feel I have a need to communicate with people who are on the same path than I am.
Yeah.
And I was hoping you would be one of these.
Well, that's great. Why don't you put us to the test? Everyone on this call is more or less a long-term spiritual aspirant. Some of us are happy to refer to ourselves as long-term spiritual losers. I wouldn't want to accuse you of being one of those.
Well, how can you lose? As long as you look for something, you find something, you cannot lose.
Okay, the meeting is yours.
Oh, no. I'm sorry.
No, I'm just teasing. Yeah.
Jeff, can I ask something?
Sure, yeah.
When you asked that guy if he was awake?
Yeah.
When you're asking that question, what are
where are you going with that?
Yeah, where are you going with that? Yeah.
I don't really know. I mean, yeah. it's kind of so open-ended, you know. It's just interesting to see how someone might reply to that.
Okay.
You know?
Yeah.
But that's, you know, it's like, what do I know? I mean, you know, obviously you start throwing around, spiritual words and non-duality and finding your true heart and being a psycho-spiritual counselor and teacher. You start throwing that shit around. I think it's fair play to ask the guy, you know, so are you awake?
Mm-hmm.
You know, not necessarily having anything in particular in mind.
Then
he was, you know, cordial enough to say, you know, if you're asking if I'm like, are you asking me if I'm like Ramana Maharshi? The answer is no.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I just thought, well, that's cool. You think there was a Ramana Maharshi, so the answer must be no. You have an idea that there was a Ramana Maharshi, then obviously you're not that Ramana Maharshi. But that's fun. Yeah, so Monique, what kind of spiritual stuff are you fond of? Are you an ardent non-dualist or into yoga or mono diets or?
Oh boy, you know, I have been, depending on the stage of my awakening, I have been studying this or that. I started to be, I was studying esotericism with Rosicrucian.
Oh, Rosicrucian.
Yeah, I was in France, and when I came here, then I, at some point, he didn't provide me any more answers, so I went with people like Wayne Dyer, Caroline Mace, and then,
then
I moved to, healing, and I did, energetic healing, which I studied. Oh, I have to tell you, I'm a scientist. I've been doing research all my life. So I'm a researcher in one way.
Yes.
And then a researcher at the physical level, and so researcher on the spiritual level.
Oh.
So I've been working for big pharmaceutical companies until about almost 4 years ago, when I decided it was not for me anymore. I have also a master's in nutrition, so now I'm a nutritionist. So
wonderful.
I know, of course, every day I'm keep up to date with the latest finding and what's good for our body and what's not good. So, you know, I'm a researcher. I have a soul of a researcher, so I do that with my nutrition. I do it with that with my soul. I do it with science also. And I'm open to everything as long as my I feel like I'm in agreement with it. I have to agree at the soul level with that.
Yes, right. Oh, good.
And right now I'm studying with somebody called Matt Kahn. He to me is
Matt Kahn. Yeah,
yes.
He's a presence on our Earth as a lieutenant of the Pleiadian culture.
So to me, I mean, I've been working for the Course in Miracles. At some point, the Course did not give me any more answers, and I was praying to find somebody.
I don't think the Course has all that many answers. It just has a lot of questions written in Old English.
Yes. And it's too cold for me. I need more heart centers. So anyway, so Matt, I found Matt about 2 years ago, and since then I've been working with him.
Very good. So, do you have any remaining suspicions about the nature of consciousness or your own participation in the wondrous field of living?
What do you mean by suspicious?
Well, would you say that you are, you know, sated, complete, relaxed, and sanguine with your spiritual studies, or is there something that might still be, you know, let's say, nagging at you?
Well, I would say I have my ups and downs.
Ups and
so
downs.
So when I remember and have time to meditate in the morning and center myself,
I
am much better than when I rush out to go to my workplace.
I see.
So that's my best answer. But so I'm still 1 foot in the third dimension, 1 foot in the fifth dimension.
Oh, what are you skipping the fourth?
Well, you know, in between.
Well, very good. All right. Well, if anything comes to mind that you might like to ask, no one here has any meaningful knowledge, but we would certainly, you know, be happy to re-question your question.
Okay.
Yeah. And it's wonderful to have you here, and thank you for such a candid review of your very exciting and enviable life.
Well, thank you so very much. Well, can I know a bit about you guys, or?
Well, we all met a long time ago, a really long time ago, on the set of the Mickey Mouse Club.
Oh.
And we are retired Mouseketeers that had to give up our ears because of really bad behavior. So now we linger here on this Zoom meeting just kind of to reconnect.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I'm being, you know, fun and facetious. Everyone on the call has their own kind of curious background and are familiar with many of the things that, you know, you mentioned. We have a pharmaceutical professional in our midst, and a master carpenter and sculptor in our midst. We have a psychotherapist in our midst. We have a professional engineer with Secret Service clearances. we have a database engineer that works for the city of New York. People here with all kinds of skills and interests and background.
We're all very impressive, yeah. Mm-hmm.
And I'm a CPA.
Well, useful. Next time.
Yeah. So if it turns out I can't assist you with any of your more intimate spiritual questions, maybe I can do your taxes.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
Well, Ronnie, how did you find out that?
I found out, but when I have a good friend who was supposed to join the call, I'm surprised he's not here. His name is Bill Sabe, and he sent me the link.
Oh.
And to be honest, I signed up, but you know, you are a bit far away from where I live, and your meetings are on Sunday morning during my yoga session. So I have to choose between yoga and you.
You chose correctly.
And you know, because it's much closer too.
We meet Thursday night, Friday night, Sunday morning, and Tuesdays here on this phone call. So it's much easier to join us here on the phone call.
On the phone call.
Right, yes.
Yeah.
It is, yeah.
Great.
So that's how, so Bill, because we studied together with Matt Kahn, so he was telling him how I was needed to find a group of people who think, or who may think the way I do.
Yes.
And he sent me the link, and that's how I got into your group.
Excellent. Well, thank you for being here. As I mentioned, chime in anytime if anything comes to mind that you might like to share.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Sure. Okay, then. Anyone else have an inspiration they'd like to speak about?
Did that guy have a response to your rifting off all those spiritual teachers or anything?
No, I haven't heard from him since.
Okay.
Yeah. But I was enthused, as I mentioned to Dave earlier, that he wrote. He took the time to write to me at all, you know, after I questioned his credentials on his own meetup.
That's true.
you know, most everyone around here that pretends to be spiritual, if you give them a little poke, they just spit up bile. So, and then Beth did a little research because she knows how, and she saw that he was associated with another previous meetup in Bethlehem, 800 strong, which was a predominantly Abraham Hicks, you know, meetup.
I read a psychotherapy thing. There's so many words. Like at this point, I can only read like tweets, so it was like a pretty kind of lengthy write-up.
Right. So, I mean, you know, if you're a mental health professional, you're already at a disadvantage.
I would say.
You know, and if you've had a successful, you know, life and practice, you know, working with and or assisting people in their mental health issues, and then you try to enroll them in the, you know, the catharsis of liberation, it just seems a little bit incestuous to me.
Oh, like those things don't necessarily go together.
Well, let's say I come to you as a, you know, therapist, and I have intimate issues that I, you know, might or might not even be sharing with my wife. And,
mm-hmm.
you know, so you become a paid confidant to assist me with, you know, life challenges and life failures, and then I'm going to come to you also you know, for your guidance as a spiritual mentor. I mean, it just doesn't feel right. You know, a certain boundary has been voluntarily entered into that doesn't really make sense when it comes to, let's say, you know, liberation discovery, which I like to feel is, you know, egalitarian. And you're already in a, you know, a role, right, of advantage and disadvantage if you've come to someone as a therapist. Why would you want to fill your so-called satsang or sangha with people that were psychotherapeutic clients of yours? I mean, that just seems like, you know.
Like one thing's in the context of human struggle and...
Well, it's not, yeah, it's not just that the context is absolutely different. It's also that the role play, the dynamics of role play and power are, in the advantage of the therapist's hands, not in the client's hands.
Mm.
Yeah. And that's not healthy for what I would say, you know, the shared investigation into personal catharsis. But the therapist already has an unfair advantage.
It's also, it might be seen as sort of a bait and switch type of thing. You know, they're there for
yes,
their psychological help or what have you. And
that's right.
And it could easily be perceived that you're laying a spiritual trip on them.
It's a boundary issue. It's a serious boundary issue. And I don't think they mix very well. Yeah. But, hey, it's all is fair in love and war out there in the world of, you know, getting ahead spiritually.
But I'm not so sure if he may present himself that way in the first place. So, I mean, I don't...
They might know what they're getting, I guess, from the get-go.
Yeah. I know this, as long as you're honest about it going in.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. Well, he's meeting this Thursday evening up in Bethlehem. For this new, you know, group, non-dual group. And Paul Hederman's coming back east to town and speaking in Doylestown, which was kind of surprising, through an NA or 12-step group that meets at a church right, you know, on Main Street.
Cool.
Yeah, I was like, fantastic. Paul's going to be in Doylestown, and I don't have to do anything but, you know, show up. I can probably even get high in the parking lot and enjoy it even more than,
you don't have to subsidize the donation basket.
I don't have to put my own money in it and then pay Pebble Hill for their fair share. Exactly. Yeah. So that'll be a lot of fun.
Yeah.
For sure.
Are you going to post that meeting?
I sent something out, and I'll make sure that you get a copy of it. You can also go to Paul's, Zen Bitch Slap, website. You'll see his schedule. He's going to be in, Dover and Nyack and Manhattan and Brooklyn and, you know, Bethlehem and Doylestown. Yeah.
It's crazy, a good gig.
Yeah. And most of it seemed like, affinity groups through his 12-step, you know, the broader 12-step community.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I think they draw more people, you know, than Doylestown people looking for enlightenment.
Desperation draws lots of people, Jeff.
Yeah, that's right. That's right.
I was reading something before this started, and it was a book that I thought I'd thrown it away, and getting ready for this trip, I decided to just toss it in. Because it didn't do much for me when I first read it, but it seems to, it's landed a little bit different.
Uh-huh.
And it was one of the early chapters has you take a pretty good look at the insanity of the thinking self, like the experience of thoughts and what the thinking self brings forth for you on a regular basis.
Yes.
And this is nothing new. I mean, I've studied different ways of this, but the suggestion was, if you took that constant stream of talk that happens in your mind day in, day out, and put it in the form of another person standing outside yourself, you'd probably either shoot them or get a restraining order or something, but it would get very obvious how insane that particular voice is.
Yeah, well put, sure.
And yet that voice is what is our constant companion, and despite all of its bad advice on a regular basis,
That's where we go to tell us what this world is.
That's insane. Yes.
It is.
Yeah. I want seeing it in that light, the loyalty that we place in our narrative and the comfort that we seek from that narrative, to place ourselves, you know, in a condition or a set of coordinates that helps us groove and move through the day, you know, could be considered by a more insightful person to be absolutely insane.
All you have to do is, like, actually pay a little bit of attention to it to see how insane it is.
Well, that's why so few people are, you know, actually drawn to or will practice meditation, because if you sit quasi still and somewhat quietly, boy, that's just going to come streaming in, right? I mean, your own neurosis is just going to come streaming in. Because the ability to avoid it through, you know, darting and distraction and entertainment, gets taken away from you when you participate voluntarily, in, you know, meditation or contemplative practices that hold you captive, to yourself.
Or involuntarily in the case of, like, solitary confinement or even.
Yes.
You know, when the doors close on that jail cell and there's no more running, it's not.
Yeah.
It's not being confined in itself, I think, as much as just being confined with this, with the head that just doesn't stop. Don't
yeah.
leave me alone with this, man.
Yeah. It's interesting because, you know, we have that kind of bifurcated schizophrenia. On the one hand, if you're Tom Hanks on a Pacific island, you will turn Wilson into your best friend.
Yeah.
Right? And then, which may be similar to the impulse of not really being able to stand oneself in any kind of isolation.
How is it that, you know, that it's not personal then?
What do you mean? The irritability that we have with our own mind?
Yeah, like the thought streaming. If it's not personal, how come it seems so specific?
Yeah, that's really fun to look at. Yeah, well, it's not personal, but aren't we miraculously familiar? I think it's because it's so familiar. This one stream of consciousness, one's quality of sensation, one's so-called persona or way of responding to, you know, moment-to-moment experience is profoundly familiar. And so it's felt, therefore, as personal, right? It's the recognition, the familiarity and the recognition of the, call it the otherwise impersonal functioning of consciousness.
Impersonal,
yeah.
Meaning like it's not specific to a person, right?
Well, impersonal could mean it's not specific to a person because the notion of a person is contrived from very, mm-hmm. very, very fragile evidence. But it's also not personal in that, you know, the presentation of consciousness and your being held captive to it is involuntary.
But couldn't you say that it is personal, but we just misunderstand personal. Personal is actually shared.
Well, that's lovely too. Yeah, personal can be a hell realm and personal can be, you know, release.
But, you know, I mean, everybody has their own personal, but it's like, really, it's all the same personal.
Yes, know? Right. So, yeah, of course. So we're looking at, can we call them concurrent electron orbits, a kind of quantum entanglement, where we can be experiencing the miracle of firsthand experience as being gleefully or tragically personal, but we can also experience it as being profoundly impersonal and therefore, you know, liberating.
Yeah.
How strange. And so what is the difference, if there is a difference, between the, call it the habitual quality of entrainment that forces us to see things as being personal and therefore perhaps remarkably unsatisfactory, as contrasted with the miracle of seeing the radiant nature of inclusivity as impersonal and therefore liberated from, you know, right, the banality of so-called personal suffering. And here we are. you know, it's like flip a coin. Go personal or go home, or go radiant and, you know, live with the gods. Same old shit, right? Here it is. It's in your face. And that's why, let's say, the, you know, metaphor of liberation is such a curious one. Because it's the same body of evidence. I mean, we don't have to, like, you know, leave Bucks County and get ourselves over to Ramana Ashramam as soon as possible to, you know, be, you know, serious enjoyers of liberation. So there's no place else to go. There's no one else to be. And that's why the, let's call it the shift in orientation from narrative consciousness to textural consciousness, is strange. And both are, we could argue, of equal measure, though our conditioned tendency, is to go back to the default of narrative consciousness. Even though we're streaming in textural consciousness without a center, like Jeff Foster might say, nonstop.
That narrative consciousness and the, I guess the exposing it for the insanity that it is, that's exactly what Maggie does. She takes the story of self and unravels it to the point where she kind of just lays it right or pushes it right in your face how freaking insane it is.
Yeah.
And she's kind of like a master at how warped normal thinking is and kind of the normal tricks that it plays.
Yeah.
In the interest of keeping a self in place and keeping the story.
Yes. Oh, look at the tricks. I mean, I can be happy and sad. I can be evasive. I can be defended. I can be undefended. I can, you know, be enthusiastic. I can be morose. I can be self-deprecating. I can be self-celebrating. And all of these apparent dichotomies are all of the same nature, which is the game of keeping the narrative self, you know, with their lid on the jar.
One of the best tools that I took away, even though I don't really do the work anymore, is just pencil to paper, write out all the bullshit that my mind has attached to that's making me squirm.
Yeah.
I just write it out regularly. I write out the insanity.
Yeah.
And make it explicit.
Yeah.
And then usually it kind of loosens. It's
That's lovely. I mean, you know, even the writing out requires, let's just call it a constructive intervention as a mindfulness tool to pay sufficient attention to the roaming of one's own neurosis and plot it out to say, whoa. You know, it's easier in a sense to try to wiggle free or avoid ourselves if we remain half attentive to it. Writing it out is a way of being more fully attentive to it, which through that catharsis will sometimes, you know, release it. Yeah, I mean, anything we do with the, you know, the onslaught of narrative consciousness is, you could say, a useful response.
Well, you know, the thing about writing...
Jamie froze. Maybe it was a really, really good question, and then he just...
Really nice having him here.
It was such a good question, he just spontaneously woke up and froze, yeah. All right, you're back, James. What was your question?
My back. It's like the way that I would write a poem. When I put pen to paper and try to come up with something, it just doesn't work. The narrative doesn't translate into
nice.
I'm not good at that textural conversion.
Yeah. Right.
You know, so to me, it just stays in the realm of logic or whatever.
You know? Right, right. Well, you know, some personality styles for some people it's kind of an easier transition to move from narrative consciousness to textural consciousness, but depending on your tonality, it could be a strongly somatic sense or an auditory sense, a visual sense, right? And not everyone is at the same, let's say, level of converting narrative consciousness to textural consciousness and bringing along poetic vocabulary for the ride.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, textural conversion sounds like a good name for a rock band, though.
It does. Yeah. Well, you know, here we are. We're rehearsing. I mean, we're, you know, we're, you could say, kind of acquisitive and grasping by, you know, by nature, right? In other words, our relationship with living can be seen to be punctuated by a subtle form of grasping, a subtle form of narrative, a subtle quality of becoming, a subtle quality of seeking safety, of aiming for refined spiritual experience and hoping that it, you know, stays longer than it has in the past. Right? So that kind of a roiling, right, habit of, you know, engaging with present experience through the, you know, the myth of becoming. We think charges us up, you know, gives us a reason to go on living, gives us a reason to go on doing and moving and shaking and planning and plotting and entering into relationships and stuff. But it might turn out that, it could turn out that the cessation of that, habit might open, different, you know, windows into what else consciousness might have in store for us. But it's not psychiatric, it's not behavioral, it's not the resolution of anything, it's not an ameliorative, it's not fucking healing. It's just not. The magic is discontinuous. It's the magic of discontinuity with from the myth of, you know, being a durable creature or even a packet of experiencing. Such is the nature of the, can we say, the quiescence. It's lovely. Yeah. See, the, you know, if the mind, what we call the mind, is starved, like one, you know, feeds a fever and starves a cold, or the other way around. If the narrative consciousness is starved from becoming, from having another story to tell, then it will, you know, move, we could say, move somewhat effortlessly, if not entirely effortlessly, into textural consciousness, the consciousness of what's up, the consciousness of, oh, this is, wow, this is, the way this is felt is a miracle in and of itself. Because this is still felt, just the way that it's felt, you know, without the presumption of the subject or the projection of the object. There's a lot of, I would, you know, say liberation to be, enjoyed just by seeing that this is felt without the movement of, you know, narrative overlay, the movement of the weather reporter. And that's something that, you know, from a yogic point of view, that we could say takes a little time to get accustomed to and to value. So that resting in textural consciousness becomes, well, could we say a sought after pastime? and you don't have knowledge there. There's no knowledge. There's no accomplishment. There's no deficiency. There's no healing. There's no telling anyone any great news about yourself. You know, there's no claim to be made. There's nothing to resolve in your so-called past. being is autonomous and being is sovereign. And, you know, here it is. Knock, knock, who's there? The sovereignty of being. Oh, why didn't you say so? Come on in. Come on in, let's have tea. Yeah, and that's fun to discover and play around with, the lightness of being when no story is told. Why should we look at you know, the demonstration of awakening as an only as an involuntary catharsis that you might be sitting around and waiting to happen? Why can't we look at the beauty of textural consciousness as right at hand? And therefore a chalice that can be sipped from. The chalice with the palace and the vessel with the pestle. Yeah, I mean, consciousness, narrative consciousness is, you know, is the, call it the harmonic of restlessness. Narrative consciousness is the harmonic of insufficiency, of imagining a genesis, that doesn't actually exist. Imagining, you know, a hoped for, outcome that can't ever possibly occur. So it's a, you know, we could say a maturing capacity, a quality of a cultivated insight, to withdraw, you know, from being a captive audience to narrative consciousness and to, you know, lean into, bathe in, right, immerse in the companion reality of textural consciousness, that this is felt, that it is, well, it is exactly how it's presenting. And thankfully, it needn't be more or less or anything other than exactly how it is being felt by you right now. Right? If there isn't it true, if there's the slightest hint of disquietude with this being felt exactly the way it's being felt by whomever you are or aren't right now, then the launch of the mercurial appetite of becoming gets lit. Yeah, it's funny. It's fun to see, actually, you know, like just watch, you can feel yourself have a moment or two of like, well, no measurable care in the world, and then leap into that mercurial seduction of, you know, what's in it for me. It's a lovely kind of schizophrenia.
Wouldn't say that's part of our biology.
Well, yes, call it that, but you know, it's not important to give it a cause, right?
Just because it exists.
Yeah, that we can notice it, have the enjoyable repartee to point it out, you know, to articulate it, sense it in ourselves, is its own enjoyment without having to hold something accountable. Because let's say it was the biology. Well, what's the biology? Right? And well, the biology is, you know, my, carbon, nitrogen, and every other thing I'm made of. Well, what's that? Well, I don't know, molecules and chemistry, atoms and photons. And what exactly are those? Well, those are quarks and subquarks, and maybe down below those are Higgs bosons. And what's that exactly? Oh, well, life's a magazine. You know, how much? $2. $2? That's absurd. That's life. What's life? A magazine. $2. That's absurd. What's that? Life. Life's a magazine. So anywhere you land that says this is because of that, fortunately turns out not to be true. There is no this because of that. I mean, and that's both delightful and could be a little scary. Because our personality, our quarrels with the world, all you could say exist because of this is because of that. And there is no this because of that anywhere to be found. That whatever this is can be discerned in the way that it's discerned, or that we can have a warm and friendly conversation and share a handful of metaphors is really like, you got to be kidding me. How is this even possible? I mean, how is this possible? Because of Stephen Hawking? You know, or maybe it was Howdy Doody. You know, like pick your progenitor. I mean, it's so odd that this is so profoundly dumbfounding that to blame it on the Arcturians or the Pleiadians or the Pilgrims is insane, because it is so transcendent of any, you know, group of beings, terrestrial or extraterrestrial, presently or previously existing, that there's just no point in blaming anything on anybody.
So where do you think the impulse to question comes from?
The same reason why your teeth are made out of enamel.
It's just natural.
I guess. I mean, what else? If we don't call it natural, should we call it unnatural? Right?
Unnatural would imply contrived.
Well, natural does too.
So it defies a certain kind of logic that things just are.
Yeah. Yes. Thank you. Yes. I mean, if it's a fact that we're having this experience, and who knows if we are, because I don't know what experience you're having. I'm not even sure what experience I'm having. That I could say we're having the same one would be absurd. And so, you know, that there might be a certain kind of affection occurring through being together in a two-dimensional realm, you know, with audio visual cues, is like, oh, whoa. Yeah. This is the, you could say narrative consciousness functions the way that it does through a certain kind of hubris, which is to imagine that it has found something that it can be sure of. And if you've found something that you can be sure of, you should be going to a Byron Katie workshop right about now. For all of us, right? If you've found anything at all that you can be sure of, well, you know, you need to spend a lot of time and money becoming as unsure as possible as fast as possible. Or not. Isn't it fun that the unavoidable textural, you know, dare I say, miracle of present being is not the consequence of anything? You are not the consequence of anything. Nothing actually came before you. The universe was not here before you were born. And it's quite frankly, it's not here now. Because you weren't born.
So you're describing something that's primary.
Well, yes, we could say primary, but there's, since there's nothing secondary, it's almost foolish to refer to it as primary. You see what the mind has to do?
Yeah, that's right.
Right? It's funny. He's like, well, primary means a lot only because there's so much secondary. No, all there is primary, so you may as well call it, you know, Mountain Dew.
So if there's only one, how come we make like a billion things out of one?
Well, that's a lovely question. I mean, there might be someone at a higher pay grade than me that actually has a cosmological reply to that.
Not that this mind really needs to have an answer. It's just...
And it's possible that it doesn't actually do that. It just only apparitionally suggests it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Because you can't find anything other than however whatever this is or isn't. And so, though it might look like it's the world of the 10,000 things, it's still only that so-called primary thing, which is not a thing that could never actually depart from itself, but entertains itself by appearing to be divergent. Right? If there were a liberated mind, and there might be one up in Bethlehem, thanks to James Stroll, you could say that such a mind was not confused by either the apperception of oneness or the presumption of duplicitousness. Such a mind is not carving present experience into numbers. Now, if that turns out to be a joyful state, far out, who knows? Who knows? You know, if you start selling your enlightened condition, then you've done your friends a disservice, because there is no enlightened condition, and whatever there is to find is yours alone. You know, if someone is happy and strokes peacocks and has an enlightened cow in their backyard or shakes their hands around or worships and does miraculous things, that's really their problem. Your sovereignty is what you find. That's the only liberation, if there is such a thing as liberation, that matters.
But they're part of the scene that they're found.
Yeah. They are. They're like archaeological digs. Yeah, everything is occurs to you as an archaeological dig, and you're finding unfathomable so-called new data or impulse nonstop. And why shouldn't Ramakrishna appear in that field, or Pol Pot? You know, Donald Trump or, Mahatma Gandhi. Yeah, it's like, okay, what else you got? I mean, for all of our professed, ethicality and morality and religiosity, we are so fucked up. So it's nice that there are sacred beings that appear on the scene from time to time, but I could argue making anything of them is not going to help you. Though it may be a useful distraction for a while. Yeah. If there's someone that's worthy of quoting, you're in trouble.
Okay, so what does that trouble imply?
That trouble implies that, you have found sufficient substance in your experience to presume individuated existence, or that there's something other than you. Envying anything or anyone else, enlightened or otherwise, you know, suggest that you have found something other than you. And if you have convinced yourself that you found something other than you, well, then you're going to be, let's just say, an easy mark for narrative consciousness. And then get swept away in the, you know, the 10,000 things. And that's, so what? I mean, you know, the real killer Dzogchen masters, they're so good, they just say, it is of no concern whether you remain in the mind of, you know, a person, or whether you, let's say, penetrate, you know, the mystery of being and come to the great view. They're so chill about it that, that they make the point that it is of no concern. And that's a really, you know, such a lovely, if not disquieting kind of teaching, because for as long as it might be a concern, then it would suggest you have found something other than yourself. And so the great liberation that one might crave for will therefore always evade you. It can only be, you could say, as the result of being no concern, that you are sufficiently dematerialized. Because there's no longer any binding of the mind's capacity to hypnotically suggest objects. The miraculous capacity to suggest objects is no longer binding. Therefore, you know, the imagination of being unliberated and in search of liberation is of no concern. Most of the freedom that is sold, you know, by the wooden Indians that stand outside of cigar stores, like the list of people that our friend James Stroll shared with me, that is a false liberation. Mm. It's almost embarrassing that someone would invite you to England or Dublin or the Ukraine, or even up to Bethlehem, to speak to people. What would you speak to them about? What great news would you bring to them? You know, what's that like? You know, what really? I mean, I know Paul Hederman travels and Wayne Lickerman does a lot of traveling, and you know, Gary Weber sometimes leaves, you know, his hovel.
It's not like we haven't hosted those people,
yeah. Yeah, I know. Would you? I mean, if someone invited you to speak, you would say, "You got to be kidding me! What? Are you crazy?" You know, you'd have to decline. You'd have to decline. You're gonna fly all the way to Dublin to talk to a bunch of Irish alcoholics about traveling lighter, and they're gonna benefit from your so-called presence. It's like the whole thing stinks, you know, from the very beginning. But we appreciate the you know, the culture of the spiritual stand-up comics.
If somebody invites me to speak, I show up.
You have something to say. You are wonderful to listen to.
I have to say that, but I show up and I offer what I think might be helpful. And I don't claim I have anything of value, but I just, if I'm asked, I usually show up.
Yeah. Yeah, no, I'm all for it. I only say the shit that I say because nobody has ever, nor will they ever invite me anywhere.
No, actually, you broke through on that one, Jeff. You actually had a breakthrough at Pebble.
So I have all I have is envy for, you know, spiritual celebrities that are actually invited somewhere to share the good news. My whole existence smells like sour grapes. Doesn't everybody's?
Well, Susan, why do you just insult them?
Fools! Fools! Why would you invite a meat puppet to speak with you?
You commit Harry Carey in public with words.
Yeah.
True.
Really?
You're all like, if you meet the Buddha on the road, kill him.
Oh yeah. Well, you're better off killing yourself. Leave the Buddha alone. Take your own life. Then we wouldn't have to listen to Rick Archer.
Who are you calling Buddha? You
know? Exactly. You know, the unshakable delight that we may have had for a few minutes while we were children, you know, was irrational. Right? The innocence of our childhood was irrational. It was you know, beyond subject and object. It was a, you know, purely sensually driven relationship with textural consciousness. Mm-hmm. And, you know, then the narrative consciousness kicks in through the naming convention, you know, and the toilet training. I was never so good at that.
You're working on it.
I'm still working on it. Yeah, really. And then, you know, you could see that, you know, those wonderful stories you hear about, you know, young children that turn to the baby in the family and plead with the baby, baby, don't let me forget. Please don't let me forget. You know, because they're still in that zone where they're actually capable of articulating.
Sad.
Huh? It
that's
is
what's sad.
But here we are.
Yeah.
Here we are. I mean, we're the product of that sadness. Yeah, you know, the adult narrative consciousness is the product of that sorrow. The loss of you know, a textural delight. And so it is very challenging. I mean, let's remember, not that this is true, but it's a context, that we're a so-called, you know, species on a so-called planet, and we're still, you could say, very, very young, though our technology has outstripped our capacity to integrate its prowess. But you could say, you know, our primary goal is not necessarily drilling and burning fossil fuels or even going to Mars. Our primary goal, as a very young, naive species, is to integrate the, you know, the wisdom of textural consciousness with the, let's just say, the cogent responsibility of societal structures. You know, we are still too primitive and violent and acquisitive. So we haven't succeeded at that, you know, most profound, gift, you know, the flowering of a, you know, call it a mature, consciousness. We're still very fractured and like those people that search for extraterrestrial life say that it might be very difficult for two, can we say, mature species to ever meet, because the universe is perhaps so vast and the possibility of intelligent life is so remarkable. But the species that are capable of utilizing the electromagnetic spectrum for off-planet communications usually extinct themselves very quickly. So even though there may be tons and tons and tons and tons and more tons of life just about everywhere, that they might actually exist concurrently, or are able to, you know, reach each other within the confines of the speed of light as an electromagnetic capacity for communion is just very, very unlikely.
But that whole vastness of space and distance implies a great deal of time and
space. It all does. Of course it does. Yeah, space implies time, and time implies space. And even at the wondrous so-called speeds of the speed of light is way too slow to get anywhere.
It's true.
The speed of light is too fucking slow to get anywhere.
Well, we need a quantum drive. That's the only way.
Well, that's the Night Sky saga.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Or one of those Doctor Who places.
Yeah, that's right. And, you know, in a poetic sense, we have that. I mean, this display of, textural experiencing, is not really occurring, you know, on Earth, around the so-called local star that we've named the Sun, you know, on a certain spiral arm of what we refer to as the Milky Way, safe distance from some massively hungry and insatiable black holes. All of that is fantasy. This is occurring trans-temporally and trans-spatially and vibrating with the miraculous scintillation that's not actually made of anything. So we are functioning right here in this two-dimensional space faster than the speed of light. We are the aliens that we've always hoped to meet. Oh, it turned out that it was me. E.T. phone home. Hello. See, once the boundaries, the boundary conditions of corporeal individuation of time and space and birth and Genesis and Big Bang and, you know, the World Bank and the Rothschilds and the Illuminati and the Masons and the Pizzagate, once all of that just, you know, disappears, you know, here we are. The miracle of experiencing is exactly the demonstration of, you know, what the physicists have always been hoping to find. This is the quantum entangled double slit uncertainty.
In its all its glorious non-existence.
In all of its glorious non-existence. Yeah. Yeah. I know. That's freaked out. That's right. It makes me so happy. I want to order something from Omaha Steaks. Yeah. You see, the orientation that we get from, you know, spiritual teachings and stuff is so narrow. That's part of the frustration with it. It's so remarkably narrow. You know, what's in it for me? What's in it for my healing issues? What's in it for my psychological and emotional issues? You know, how can I use spirituality to find a soulmate? You know, or to improve my self-esteem or make more money or have, or bilocate if I'm interested, you know, in that. And even that is like, you know, bilocate. I mean, you're already everything that is. Why do you need to appear more than once? So in this, you know, aching sense of, frustration that we might feel, you know, psychologically and otherwise, we are the absolute demonstration of the mind of God. So go figure how we're able to conjure up so much evidence for being so small. Well, fuck me.
That old thing about can God make a rock that's too heavy for you to hold?
Yeah.
Sort of like, can God create concepts that are too incomprehensible for you?
Yeah.
I guess so.
Yeah, that's great. That's right. It certainly can appear so. I mean, you know, why did the Buddha get any traction at all? You know, because it can appear as if this, as Dave pointed out, you know, this primariness, this primacy, which knows no other, can fool itself with aplomb into thinking that it is indeed other than itself. And if it's once it's other than itself, then it's it's small. It's like the incredible shrinking human. Then we go, convinced of things that are untrue. And then go to psychotherapists and gurus to, wiggle free from those presumptions. And I don't think Matt Kahn can help either.
Yeah, the split is in perception, in a sense.
Yeah, that's right. The split is so subtle. It's actually so magical, can we say, because it's not voluntary, right? It's nothing you or I could possibly do or imagine. It's magical. It's irrational. It's, it's other. So in that way, it's like, whoa, I'm bombarded by, a depth of magic, which is, so incomprehensible. That to imagine a human being could or should be held responsible for, the least crumb of suffering is a kind of blasphemy. And yet, a lot of teachings and teachers and students of spiritual ways and means can often internalize something or some things they've done wrong or mistakenly to be in the condition that they're in. And that can't be true.
So what part of us is gullible enough to believe stuff like that?
Yeah. You won't find it, right? You won't find a part of yourself. You can experience, let's say, the consequence of so-called gullibility. But you won't find any componentry. That's why the Hindus might use the phrase Leela, right? As a play or a dance. This is doing itself in all the ways that it is doing itself, and there is no entity. Jean Klein was always fond of making that remark. And yet it can feel so profoundly, as like Suzanne pointed out, personal. It can feel so personal, whatever that suggests. But or and, any way this feels is incomprehensible. And how so-called consciousness layers on the confidence, which is kind of a confidence game of being accountable, responsible, being subject to, being the consequence of or the outcome of, is like, wow, how does this do that? I mean, you could say, well, look at the fermentation of narrative consciousness, right? And fermentation is anaerobic outgassing of metabolic deconstruction, and that's the mind. And an anaerobic outgassing of metabolic deconstruction. That's how it does it. We are drunk. We're all drunk on with the fermentation of consciousness, which conjures its narrative side.
Sounds like some deep yogic breathing for an antidote.
Well, deep yogic breathing has been used by many as an antidote, at least temporarily.
Yeah, get that oxygen in there.
Yeah, that's right. Reoxygenate the fermentation of your own consciousness and try to get it to be a little more aerobic, Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that's a great metaphor for all yoga. Right? Purifying the endocrine system through hatha, pranayama, and et cetera, to re-aerobicize the consciousness. Yeah, and, hopefully loosened it up. It doesn't necessarily work. You end up with a bunch of prideful yogis. Yeah. But you know, it's worth a try.
I was just thinking about where things start to go awry is something happens and then you attribute some event as being yourself, like, oh, that was great, or this is great.
Yep.
That's this sucks.
And, yes.
And then owning it as self-experience.
Yes. That's so wonderful. Owning anything as self-experience is, you know, the long-winded way of referring to samsara.
Hmm.
Isn't it fun? Because here it is, but that doesn't mean we have to own this as self-experience. But the owning of experience as self-experience is the anthropomorphization of it, is the, you know, the individuation of it, boxing it in, you know, to temporal and sensorial coordinates. Yeah, and then that's, oops, oh, oops. Yeah.
Easy job.
Uh-huh.
I mean, it, from childhood, oh, isn't that great? Oh, you're such a good blah, blah, blah.
Yeah.
Well, that wasn't nice. You're going to get in trouble. And it's, you,
yeah.
I good, I bad, you know.
Yeah. You're going to grow up to be a doctor.
Yes. When in fact, you just simply want to, you know, sit under a tree and meditate.
Yeah. Right.
Yeah, that comparison mind is quite an interesting thing to wrestle with.
Yeah, comparison mind is another metaphor for, you know, the intoxication of narrative consciousness. Yeah.
Well, it's weird that you have this mind that's at odds with your with action, and they're not, you know.
It's at odds with.
Well, with behavior, I mean.
Yes, that's true too. That's right. Yeah, we're functioning by irrational impulse, and then the weatherman comes along and makes us, and then makes us ashamed.
Has other ideas.
Has other ideas. Yeah, that's right. Yeah, that's right. Yeah, your actual cellular impulse field has its own intelligence. Yeah. To which you are not made privy.
Yeah.
And then you come along as the weather woman or weather man and with your ideas. And you're like, yeah, that's not going to work. Yeah. Yeah. That's right. Cause ideation, you know, is influenced by a whole, you could say, superset of, influences that the actual, call it metabolic or biological impulse field is just not interested in.
Yeah.
In other words, you are not really, really interested in yourself. You're functioning completely autonomously. Mm-hmm. But the narrative consciousness makes it appear as if you are really interested in yourself and that you have a say, but you don't. That could be liberating or very frustrating. Everything appearing in your mind makes it appear as if you have a say, but you don't. It's like an absolutely crazy person on crystal meth is riding on your shoulders, barking commands all over the place when your actual functioning is absolutely autonomous.
So what does have a say?
It's that back to the enamel on the teeth.
Okay.
You know, why does the sun hang in the middle of space traveling at yes, hundreds of thousands of miles an hour, whisking all these planets along, you know, like fleas that won't let go. I don't, yeah, fuck if I know.
Or why does it sometimes sink up, you know, seemingly sink up?
Yeah, seemingly sink up, like the harmonic convergence. We're still enjoying that. Yeah, I mean, it's 11:11 twice a day. On some planets, maybe even more than twice a day. How would we know?
How it's so funny how you can get cued into seeing something and it feels sort of, you know, like, oh, there's that thing again, you know.
Yeah, that's right. You know? Yeah, yeah, these serendipities that won't leave me alone.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm being chased by 308.
318.
Okay, there you go.
Hi, guys. I have to go now.
Hey, listen, Monique, okay. it was great having you. I hope this was helpful to you and contributory to your spiritual experience.
Thank you so much.
Yes. We'll see you again, I hope.
Oh, okay.
Very good.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. One down. Five to go.
Can we be more relaxed now?
I was so tense. I know. I was like, oh, my God. Oh, my God. I might have to make sense. I might have to pretend to convince someone that I'm actually worth listening to. That would be terrible.
That is self-preservation instinct.
Yeah, everyone's suffering from this because of that. And if you pull the rug on this because of that, you know, you better have some Teflon in your intestines. So, Jamie, Monique said she wants your phone number.
Yeah, I hope you gave it to her.
I did. I gave it to her.
Better watch it, Jeff. She's and Stephanie are really listening in. The CIA apps, you know.
Yeah. The NSA, boy, they've been all over this.
Yeah, it's quite a.
Yeah, that group's dangerous.
But they don't believe in this world. That's
yeah, really. There's no threat here. Move along.
Where is Monique from? Where'd she come from?
She was calling in from Valley Forge.
Oh.
Yeah.
French Valley Forge.
Yeah, the French quarter of Valley Forge.
Everybody, dig themselves out and all that stuff.
Oh, man. My back is killing me.
You went out to shovel, huh?
Oh, yeah.
All right. Live to tell the tale.
Yeah.
That's heavy snow, heavy.
Yeah.
Oh, man.
Either I'm getting older, that snow's getting a lot heavier.
No, that was really wet, wet sleet, right?
Wet. Icy snow.
Yes, heavy, heavy moisture saturated stuff.
Yeah.
Listen, if I can't get rid of the snow with a leaf blower, I'm leaving it.
Yeah.
That's all I can carry. I carry, you know, plug the leaf blower in, see if I can move the powder around. If it's not budging, I go back into the house and make pancakes. Yeah,
this wasn't that type of snow.
No.
It's good to have a leaf blower. Over there. Is that
it? Yeah.
I think you need a little napalm for this stuff.
Yeah.
Are we out of the woods yet, or apparently there's more snow coming, right?
I don't know.
A little snow tomorrow, right? But I don't know if it's a lot. Does everybody go to work? This is the underemployed section.
Wednesdays I usually work from home, so.
Oh, okay.
There you go. You didn't go on 202 today, right?
No, I actually went in yesterday instead.
Oh, okay.
I switched my Monday and Tuesdays.
Oh, got it. All right. That was nice of you to, you know.
To anticipate,
Do something on your employer's behalf to anticipate the snowstorm. Well done. That was a spiritual move.
Yeah, right.
Government was shut down.
Yeah.
Was that it?
Government. Oh, that's you. You didn't have a California conference call today?
Nope.
Yeah. That's nice. How'd you, what'd you do? Did you, Did you take a bath or go shopping? What'd you do out there?
No, I went to work.
Oh, you went to the office.
I couldn't go to the facility I was supposed to dial in from, but I went to work.
Oh, okay.
There was, it was like nothing. It was just kind of slushy.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. Yeah. Are you like south of Dulles?
Right by Dulles. You see monster airplanes go over all the time.
Okay.
It's called Chantilly, and it's right by Dulles.
Yeah.
They go right by the airport exit.
Nice. That's where you are now, man?
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, I'm here for the week. I figured I had more of a chance of actually getting my work weekend from down here than I did from up there, and I was right.
Where are you staying? That picture looks kind of pretty above your head. What is that?
It's Marriott, America's finest.
Oh, it's a Marriott. Oh, yeah. Nice.
Wow, that's nice.
I got a kitchen.
Far out.
That's going to Target right by.
I thought I'd see a bunch of empty wine bottles on your coffee table.
No, just balls.
And a male escort or something.
Yeah, male escort. He's hiding.
I tell him to be quiet while I'm doing that.
Yeah.
You have to pay extra for that, but yeah, it's worth it.
I had a non-dual conversation with a bunch of people from work today.
Oh, do tell.
Well, they sort of noticed I wasn't wearing my wedding ring, and some of the guys asked, like, hey, what's up with that? Because I
wow.
Dead, but I said something about something. I was like, yeah. So, you know, my husband and I are separated, but, you know, we're still seeing each other, and I have no idea what I'm doing. And everybody agreed, nobody has any idea what they're doing.
In their respective marriages? Or at all?
In the jobs, everything. Like,
yeah.
It was kind of the joking consensus among this small group of engineers that happened to be at work on a snow day.
Yeah.
That nobody really knows anything.
Wow.
It's pretty cool. Like, you wouldn't get that from some of the more straight-laced folks in Valley Forge where I work.
Right.
But it was pretty funny. These guys hold it a little looser down here.
That's what I would call a near saga data day.
Yeah. It was fun.
Yeah.
And I've always gotten that they're just much more relaxed, and they're closer to the insanity, so they just don't.
Yep.
They don't hold it that tight.
Yeah, they go into the kitchenette and whip up some ramen and whipped cream.
That's it. We know how to live down here.
too much fun.
Yeah.
Oh, boy. You know, it's the lucidity that one is, you could say, sitting on, or the lucidity that's actually animating us is, I mean, it's startling. It's startlingly profound. And to access that lucidity with a certain kind of conscious affection seems to, you know, occur when the inertia of ourselves, the familiar inertia of ourselves, relaxes. That's, you know, one way you could say that we reclaim our child like innocence, our childlike abandon. And that, I would say, is a more useful spiritual tool as spiritual tools go, than the ones where we try to, you know, improve ourselves or concretize ourselves or really anything at all. You know, to discover the lucidity that you're made of suggests that one untether from the inertia of rationality, the inertia of the story of oneself. And so, you know, chatting about the way that we do could be nonsensical or frustrating or unsatisfying, you know, to someone that's kind of chiming in without, you know, a more thorough orientation. But to me, it's, you know, nicer than laying down tracks, which make it look like there's a cause or that a thing is a thing because of a thing that can be called a thing and named a thing that has implications for you. Because nothing has any implication for you, because you're just made of radiant irrationality, radiant, radiant lucidity. And that's why the sense of self can get stuck, by, you know, carrying around the history of one's personal lamentation and aiming for, an already determined amelioration. So if I have a sense of a belligerent expectation for release, then the burden of myself hasn't let go one iota. So it's a little more unsettling, but perhaps has a different kind of utility that we don't know. Nothing.
The belligerent expectation for release brings me back to the word that I tossed out there at the beginning, desperation.
Yeah, that's right.
That painful, it's like, let me the fuck out of here.
Yeah, that's the very functioning or outgassing of desperation. Yeah, the belligerent clinging to the citadel of suffering that I am so certain of that I've really lost touch with the playful capacity of, lucidity. Because I'm so hell-bent on one or a million things being relieved in the way that I insist that they are relieved.
We're desperados waiting for the train.
Desperado. Yeah. Yeah. Los tres amigos. Yeah. Yeah, I mean, to have a, an at-hand spiritual itinerary becomes its own, prison. Because this doesn't give a fuck. And that's the good news. This doesn't give a shit how much I've suffered. And it doesn't give a shit what I think needs to happen to suffer less. So, I mean, what are you going to do? Are you going to get on board with what this actually is? Or are you going to keep placing demands upon it when it's going, la, 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 I can't hear you? It's definitely better to go to failure.
The biggest reason why this conversation is so corrosive, it just whisks out from under you the impulse to fix it.
Yeah.
Which leaves you with this sort of bare.
Yeah. 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 Well, it's full to the brim with nothing.
Yeah. It's more of a preoccupation with nothingness rather than a preoccupation with, some ameliorative.
Yeah. Yeah. That's nice. The preoccupation with nothingness is the dawn of textural consciousness, and the preoccupation with, you know, content and quarrels is the rumination of narrative consciousness. Yeah. It's always empty and it's just waiting for you. So if I keep coming at it, you know, through the presumption of having, you know, something that's wrong with it, me, or everybody else, it's like, I'd like to help you, but you've got too many ideas. I want to help you. I love you, but you just won't get jiggy. You won't get down with emptiness. And it's not my position or business to, you know, cure you of your ideas. That's why this, you know, the psychotherapeutic approach to spirituality is bad news. Because there's too much momentum in there for curative impulse.
Well, yeah. That's what the whole profession is based on.
That's right. It's based on it. And of course, you know, we can honor and respect that profession in the way that it's used to assist people that are suffering in the various ways that people are suffering. You know, where I'm drawing the line here is when it comes to the playfulness of liberated irrationality, it can't be curative. It just can't be curative. And if one is approaching, you know, another so-called person, from the bias of a curative background. Sorry.
The one woman that I still do the work for, mm-hmm. I facilitate her, she does pay me. There's been moments in our working together where I just said flat out, like, what if this is all you ever get? What if it just never is ever going to get better?
Whoa.
Just who you are, how you are.
That's the Jack Nicholson moment.
I think it kind of blew her mind. She was like, it stopped her in her tracks.
Far out. Yeah. Well, you earned your fee that session. This is insane, and it just keeps tickling me. Stop. I can't catch my breath. Stop. Oh boy.
It's kind of like math not having an equation.
Yeah.
I'm trying to think, like, there's no preset idea that somebody is not well to become well, or that somebody unfulfilled to become fulfilled, or somebody frustrated and then easeful. Where do you go from where to where, you know?
Yeah. Right. Yeah. Yeah, there's nothing on either side of the equals sign. That's why it's a parallel universe.
Did you say parallel?
Yeah. The equal sign is, you know, really the...
Oh, I gotcha.
It's the SOS from a parallel universe.
Two flat lines.
And there's nothing there. There's nothing on either side.
That's cool.
I mean, it's okay to conjure a world in the midst of, unbearable hilarity. If you're conjuring a world and the volume on the hilarity has gone down, whoa, that's dangerous. If it's not imbued with, absolute hilarity, then the world gets so serious so fast, really fast.
Yeah, I can relate to that.
Yeah, right. And the movement of memory and bodily sensation and identification and, just the mirage of time, the mirage of psychological time can be, painful, incarcerating. You know, that's why if Nan, met someone that had her mind, she would have no option but to kill them.
Me or Howard.
Forget putting energy into killing the Buddha. Kill that mind.
That's right. Yeah. Like Brindlefly.
All right, folks, I gotta head out. I'll see you.
Hey, thanks for joining us on a snowy Tuesday evening.
Take it easy, Jamie.
Bye. Hello. Yeah, we're good. It's 10 after 9. We don't need to keep anybody any longer.
Okay.
All righty.
Well, thanks. Thanks for being here. That was fun.
Bye-bye.
You bet. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.